I do, thank you.
I'd like to call to order the Health and Human Services Committee for the Senate Wednesday, February 22nd. Appreciate members being here relatively on time. I think that clock is about 5 minutes fast, so we're not too bad. We have two bills today. Senator Gazelka has Senate File 1835. And members, this is a bill that we had some testimony on last week, I believe, and at that point we tabled the bill, and there's been some additional work, and so different bill. This is the first time we've had the bill in the committee, is that correct?
Yes, Senator Gazelka? But it has similarities.
Mr. Has similarities, I'm sorry. So I apologize. New bill, Senate File 1835. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate File 1835 tracks with a similar bill in the House, House File 2250. And I do have a delete all amendment, Mr. Chair. It might make more sense to do that.
All right.
Is similar language to our prior bill.
Okay, and because it's the first time this bill has been in committee, we can do that as an author's amendment. We do have a quorum. I want to note that. So Senator Gazelka moves as an author's amendment.
Mr. Chair, is this the same bill that we...
Senator Lurie, no, it's not.
Okay.
I thought it was, too, at first. I was confused,
right.
But it's a similar topic, but different bill.
So How many 60-day residency requirements are we going to hear? I'm just curious.
We'll find out.
Author's
we'll
amendment,
out.
It's fine.
Senator Lurie, author, or Senator, I guess you don't want to offer this amendment. Senator Gazelka, maybe you can't do that. You're not a member.
I'd be happy to. But.
All right. Maybe we can ask Senator Nino. Senator Nino moves the A1 amendment to Senator Gazelka's bill, the 1835. All in favor say aye.
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 The bill is in the form you wish.
You're not going to ask for the noes?
Well, we're going to give the author the courtesy to have the amendment on the bill the way he wants it.
This morning, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I believe you all have a packet of some information that I did not have prior to the last time it was before you, but I'll read through some things, and you've got a packet of information, too. But this bill is focused only on the residency requirement, and if passed, would change the waiting period from 30 to 60 days for people moving to Minnesota and applying for welfare assistance. Everyone has a constitutional right to travel, and we want to encourage people to come to Minnesota looking for work. This bill encourages people to find a job, and if they want to come to Minnesota, we're open for business. The state of Minnesota has an interest in people working in Minnesota and coming to Minnesota for work. Contrary to testimony on Senate File 1507 from DHS testifiers, the latest statistics that I have that were put together, actually the revisor's office, and I have that in your packet, from 2010, show that 25% of MFIP cases were open for people moving to Minnesota, 30.2% for a displaced worker program, and 13.1% for general assistance. Those numbers are substantially higher than what they presented here prior. In fact, almost double. Attempts to change the waiting period to 6 months or longer have been rejected by various courts across the country. But as I mentioned before but could not verify and now do verify, courts in Wisconsin have upheld Wisconsin language for a 60-day waiting period. Their Supreme Court stated that the 60-day waiting period was substantially less onerous than a 12-month waiting period, which was found to be a violation of the constitutional right to travel. Further, the court stated that while the waiting period did treat non-residents differently than residents, to do so was not in violation of the Equal Protection Clause because the state had a reasonable objective of encouraging individuals to support themselves through employment. So even though this bill addresses MPIP and GA, there are numerous other programs available to individuals and families, and when comparing them together, Minnesota is more generous than our neighboring states. The fiscal note on this, apparently it's not done because it's not exactly like the other one. It was zero on the other one because there may have been a court case, but frankly, I believe if this passes, it'll go to finance because there would be a significant savings to our state if this happens. So I'll just close and say everyone has a constitutional right to travel. We want to encourage people to come to Minnesota looking for work. This bill encourages people to find a job if they want to come to Minnesota. The state of Minnesota has an interest in people working in Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Gazelka. This bill, unlike the previous bill, does not have a photo ID provision. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I wanted to focus on one issue.
And I think, as I recall, there was some cost attached to having a photo ID, but that provision not being in this bill, there is not that cost. And we do not have a fiscal note on this bill. There is, I think, a request for one that would reflect the, assuming it were to be enacted and there was no constitutional challenge, that it would presumably show some savings, but we do not have that. And I believe that we should move it to finance if it does pass this committee.
So. Yep.
Are there questions from members? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I'm still sort of confused on these DHS numbers. Could DHS come and talk us through these?
If there is anyone from the department here that would be willing to come forward and offer some testimony on the bill. Please give us your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Mark Toogood from the Department of Human Services.
And Mr. Chair and Mr.
Senator Higgins.
I don't think I've ever seen this statement that Senator Gazelka said where there were 25% of the new cases were from people not in Minnesota or whatever it was. I'm trying to find where it was you said it. And can you just give us, expand on the information that you have about what you know about people coming from other states?
Mr. Toogood.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I haven't seen the information that Senator Gazelka has compiled here, so not quite sure how the data is coming together. Our statistics show that 14% of new GA cases, general assistance cases in 2010, were not Minnesota residents, and also in 2010, that new applicants for MFIP was about 5% from out of state. So presumably Senator Gazelka is adding some of the statistics together across all the programs.
I'm afraid that that's what's happening, Mr. Chair. And that only gets you to 19, even if you just bulk added them together. So I still don't know where the 30%, well, they've got diversionary work program cases added in as well. Do you have numbers on that, sir?
Mr. Toogood.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, it is true that if you add the DWP, diversionary work program, into that count, then that does bring it up a little bit.
The 30%?
Two different numbers.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, sorry.
That does not comport with the reports that we've got, I'm afraid.
Could you pull the microphone just a little closer, please? I'm hearing better today, but still it's hard.
I can't hear him either.
And Mr. Chair, these are not my numbers either. These are numbers that help put together for me.
Well, and I guess I've got some confusion. I see the and members in the packet that was put together. There's a memo from Kara Clausing who is saying that these are a summary of statistics from the Department of Human Services and tables that we don't have, but she's reporting statistics provided by the department that says that 25% of the new MFIP cases in 2010 were families who moved in 2010. And it talks about diversionary work program number. The second paragraph, it talks about general assistance of 13%, which seems to be similar to what the department is saying.
That's correct.
So I'm not sure if there's, I guess what I'm confused about is this document purports to say that the Department of Human Service statistics are these. But you're, Mr. Toogood, you're not sure if they are? Is
Mr.
That?
Chair, now that I've had a chance to look at it, I think the count here in the table that Senator Gazelka has includes people who moved from any location. not just from other states. So presumably that includes international settlers here in Minnesota. So it looks like it's all cases, not just people moving from other states.
So, Mr. Chair, would that be people who move from one county to another county as well?
Or is it? Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins. Mr. Tuga. No, that would be people moving into the state.
Okay.
Into the state. Sir Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Gazelka. Just if you just keep on coming back until you get it through, I can appreciate your tenacity. I think that, you know, I have a couple of questions. I guess one is, when you put everything together, part of what you're putting together is food support as well, which is administered by the Department of Agriculture, which those numbers are kind of uniformed across the country is what I suspect. So I just want us to, as you kind of start to make your case, that we know that different departments, federally and statewide, are the ones that administer these dollars, so they aren't just general fund dollars, which you seem to want to really focus in on. The other issue that I have to our testifier, and I forgot the gentleman's name from DHS, is in previous testimony last year, the year before, and the year before that, when these bills come up, there was some analysis that said, at least last year, the last couple of years, that the amount of people moving in, getting on public assistance versus the people that leave the state is negligible. In other words, there wasn't a great disparity between what we paid for people to come in that were settling, looking for work and happen to end up on public assistance versus people who were leaving the state and getting off of the Minnesota rolls. Can you comment on that, sir?
Mr. Tugan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, that is our understanding as well, and I'm citing to the state demographer's report on migration of public assistance recipients in April 2008, where, you know, they concluded there was no conclusive data to show that Minnesota is a welfare magnet, and that where there is some net inflow, that it's negligible. The differences are fairly small. So I guess overall, I think that your point is well made.
So, Mr. Chair.
Sorry. Mr. Chair, if I
so,
go ahead, Mr.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, you know, unfortunately, I have a cold today to hear my voice, and so I guess that will help Senator Gazelka today, because Senator Gazelka, Mr. Chair, I frankly, once again, can't figure out why you continue to bring the bill. You know, the testimony after testimony after testimony, we could talk about research that's been done in Wisconsin, and I'll allow our testifiers to talk about that. There is not a problem. This is not a welfare magnet. And unfortunately, you know, the one or two people in your county, someone that works, you know, with a trucking service or your local grocer who might have seen someone that they felt like was gaming the system or was disappointed that that person was living there or didn't like the way they looked or act, or they weren't, you know, as Minnesotan as they need them to be, or whatever the reason is. It's not a reason for us to go through the gyration of changing statutes, having potential court cases, taking up really valuable committee time on issues that I think we should be focused on. And DHS comes up repeatedly, with the data saying that we're not a welfare magnet, and frankly, that in this particular case, even the folks who come here, we lose just as many people. So, Senator Gazelka, Mr. Chair, once again, I think it's unfortunate that we are spending so much time on an issue that really is not an issue. And so, you know, I'll leave it with that, Senator Gazelka, and I hope that at some point we could actually learn these programs and figure out what's happening and trust our experts that are doing this work and not kind of, just kind of get something in our head that we can't get out and continue to come back and back and back. I've been working on this issue in this legislature every year since 2008. This bill or some variation comes up, and the same outcome is there, is that there is not a problem. So I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you for indulging me.
That's all right. Sir Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Hayden. First of all, I sent out the data for you, for everybody to see that they tried to focus on just one little program, and frankly, there's a lot of programs. So when people imply that there's a little benefit. You know, that isn't really accurate when you look at the many different programs available that we have that we're generous towards those that have a need. This is focused only on the issue of, is it beneficial for people to come to Minnesota to work? And the answer clearly from the state's perspective is yes, that's a benefit. Clearly some of the data I have that was not something I tried to gin up, that came from the research from Kara Clausing from the reviser's office and also Cherie Spear from the reviser's office the year before, have numbers that don't seem to jive with DHS. Well, we can maybe get to the bottom of that. Last time I was before this committee, there was an insistence that Wisconsin had no law and that there was no court understanding. Yes, it's not our court, but it's a similar court. And it was obvious, and I gave you the data so that there's no question to this group, that Wisconsin does have a law, and that there was a rendering of that, and why. And so this legislation is very similar as far as length of time to that, and I believe it would stand up to a court case, but that's what we'd have to see.
Before I call on you, I wanted just to ask counsel, Ms. White, the cover sheet to the material, you've got a table that shows Iowa, Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, adult and child, and you're saying these are approximate annual per enrollee, or is it per month?
Mr. Chair and members, this was the cover memo for the state Medicaid fact sheets that are in the back of the packet, and it is an annual amount. And
I guess the only reason I'm asking, I'm looking in the second page, and it talks about monthly public assistance benefits for a family of three, but this would be per person, and the monthly amount for a family of three seems to be over $3,000. If you add all those, the MFIP, child care, health care. I'm trying to get whether on an annual basis, or is this just for medical assistance only? Is that what this is?
Mr. Chair, this is only MA.
Okay.
And it's annual, and then if you look a couple pages back, and this was based on 2008
right.
figures, Mr. Chair. A couple pages back where it says monthly assistance benefits for family of three.
Yep.
If you look at the health care, this is an adult and two children based on more current figures of 2010, I think. And the monthly amount for three people is the $11,072.
So for three people, the MFIP or health care on MFIP would be about $1,200 a month.
Yes. And then back, if I initially used the 2008 figures, and it was about, I don't know, $890 or something. So it's gone up a little bit since.
Ms. White, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. The memo that has the list of benefits, if you look under health care, the average monthly amount for two children and an adult is about $1,200. That's based on the most recent figures we have. Now, the chart on the cover memo on the front is related to the state Medicaid fact sheets that are attached. Those are 2008 figures. I initially used those figures to determine the monthly amount, but it was out of date. But the 2008 monthly amount for two children and an adult was about $900. So it's gone up from $900 to about $1,200 since 2008. But the state Medicaid fact sheets shows a comparison of the Minnesota cost related to the contiguous states, and that's why I attached those.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
And that was really more just data for people to have. It's not really the focus of the bill. but I wanted to give more data than less data for people to make their decisions.
I'm sorry, Senator Gazelka, were you asking me a question?
No.
Are there other, Senator Sharon?
I'm going to try to absorb all these numbers, which I haven't yet, but I wanted to go back to something earlier that you said, Senator, that the motivation of your bill or the central reason for the bill is to encourage people to work.
Come to Minnesota to work.
Is to encourage people to work. So I need to understand how restricting residency or expanding the residency requirements encourages people to work. There's a disconnect in my mind about that, particularly since what we're talking about is not that. What we're talking about is whether or not Minnesota is a welfare magnet. So you need to help me connect. If you're just changing your language here, or if, in fact, as you said on your earlier bill, that this is about restricting people's access to the programs in Minnesota.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I would go back to my comments, and they are word for word from the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. And it says that if you do a 60-day waiting period, it is not substantially court stated that while the waiting period did not treat non-residents differently than residents, to do so was not in violation of the Equal Protection Clause because the state has a reasonable objective of encouraging individuals to support themselves through employment. This is what there's basically same legislation, 60-day waiting period, encouraging people to support themselves through employment. And so that is the of this bill, that is my focus. I don't have any photo requirements. It's just this one issue that I'm focused on, and that's the direction that I'm bringing this forth in.
I'll wait for Senator Lori as well, but just to follow up on that, I fail to understand how you're reading something from the Supreme Court, which I think we can respond to as well, but I don't see the connect between you're reading that and what this bill does, which extends the time of residency requirement for persons access resources. So I fail to understand how this bill achieves the objective of assisting people to work. As the intent of the bill is to assist people to work, when all of the description and the data, supportive data is about how it's suggesting, it's debatable whether or not it's valid or not, but it's suggesting that our benefits exceed those of other states, and therefore we don't want to encourage people to come here. So what you're saying and reading doesn't relate to what you're presenting.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, my focus on this is we want people to come to Minnesota to work, and this is not... I don't think this is much different than the other case where it was proved to be constitutional. And so that's where the focus of this bill is going to be.
Senator Lori, did you have a question?
Actually, I have several.
Proceed.
Senator Gazelka, you know, maybe you insist on continuing to rely on the Wisconsin. Step us through why it's applicable again and the timelines, if you would, because there's some pretty significant issues to get through, and apparently you've gone and done some more work with your researcher since the last time you were here and had trouble with this. So I'd just like to get clear on your understanding of why the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision you believe is applicable to what you're attempting to do in Minnesota.
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lori, I should say, too, that my email apparently was entered incorrectly, which is why I didn't have the data in time before. It was never getting to me. I never knew what the situation was, but that was it. They had a comma in place of a period for me. But Wisconsin, I think, is similar in many ways to Minnesota, not the same, And when you look at court cases, they often look to other courts to see what has been determined appropriate and what is not appropriate. And that is why I cite that case, because I think it at least at the very minimum is worth reviewing to see the comparison. And so that's why I bring that up. And I think the focus there clearly was that a state's best interest is people moving to their state are coming to look for work and to have employment and to do that as their primary motive. And this does not take away from that.
Senator Lori.
To the timelines, when was the Wisconsin court case determined? Was it determined under current federal jurisprudence? That's also a pretty important piece as to whether it meets today's constitutional mandates. And if you need help with that, I actually know the answers to these questions.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Gazelka.
Senator Lori, you should go ahead and proceed, but I will say that it's certainly the sheet that I gave you was there from their 2010 statute, so it's listed right in there in the material I gave to you guys. I believe the court case, I know it was within the last 10 years.
Senator Lori?
Mr. Chair, unless I'm horribly mistaken, the court case that you were reading from, and I have it in front of me, was from 1992 in Wisconsin. And it said that Wisconsin's 60-day waiting period does not penalize an individual's right to travel. It does say that. And it was from the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It was not from a Minnesota court. It goes on to say, applying the traditional equal protection analysis from 1992, we conclude that its objective of encouraging individuals to support themselves is fine. But then it goes on to say as well that is reasonable and that the 60-day waiting period is rationally related to that objective. This was 1992. Today's jurisprudence regarding residency requirements was established by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1999. In 1999, the U.S. Supreme Court said that you need to meet a strict scrutiny standard. This is a rational basis standard, the most lenient standard that the Wisconsin court applied. Strict scrutiny is the most restrictive standard in dictating what a state can and cannot do. And in fact, in response to the 1999 statement regarding how these state statutory attempts to define residency requirements will be applied to strict scrutiny, the Wisconsin, I've done a little bit of research myself, and Wisconsin themselves undertook an analysis of their 60-day waiting requirement and determined that it would not pass the new strict scrutiny that was applied by the and mandated by the U.S. Supreme Court in a piece from their workforce development, economic support, and child care. They said, however, despite these differences in the California law and the Wisconsin law, according to legislative counsel, it appears that the rationale used by the court in its decision in Sanchez, that's a U.S. Supreme Court case, is broad enough to apply to the Wisconsin statute. Wisconsin's law creates a degree of citizenship based on length of residence, which the court has held is prohibited by the 14th Amendment. It is probable that a court would find the law discriminates against newly arrived residents in violation of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution and would require the state to show, you know, meet strict scrutiny basis. Wisconsin repealed their law in 1999, right on the heels of this U.S. Supreme Court decision. Their 60-day waiting period for their general assistance program, upon advice from Wisconsin General Counsel, was repealed because the status of rules that a state's attempt to implement residency requirements is put to when reviewed by a court has changed. And so the rationale that you read in your testimony was from a 1992 decision that Wisconsin determined no longer met today's standards.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Gazelka.
You know, that was the argument last time, was that Wisconsin never even did this. And I have in your packets, I believe, from their 2000 reproduction of their 2007-08 Wisconsin database, updated and current through 2009, and Act 406 and October 31st, 2010. That sheet, and then it shows their state residency requirements on the very first paragraph, and it shows 60 days. So all I can say is what I have before me appears to be far more current than the dates you're talking about.
This statute has never come before a court. This is the first time I've seen this statute. The statute regarding that was put to their test, and that you also read from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, was a 1992 decision based on an old statute. It wasn't this statute being litigated. Today's standard is a strict scrutiny standard. You've been reading the wrong test on tape before our committee. That's the wrong test. I don't know that this Wisconsin statute from 2009 has been put to any test, and you haven't demonstrated that. So, I mean, you can't rely on the 1992 Wisconsin Supreme Court decision that has been superseded by the United States Supreme Court decision.
And just so clarify for me, Senator Gazelka, the material that you've provided, and it's, I think, on the third or fourth page of the documents packet that we have, is a page, it looks like, from the Wisconsin statutes. And what you're saying, and I would assume this is being offered as evidence, that the current statute in Wisconsin with respect to state residency requirements, and they say no individual is eligible for relief unless the individual has resided in the state for at least 60 consecutive days, and then it gives some criteria that would mitigate that. But that is the current law in Wisconsin. And your argument is that the law that you are, the bill that you're proposing, would apply to similar circumstances in Minnesota, and that therefore current law in Wisconsin is constitutional because it exists?
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
So similar law in Minnesota ought to be as well.
Yeah, I'm trying to say there are certainly there are similarities, and this is current. I did get that information again from the revisor's office, so it's not something I'm trying to make up.
No. And Senator Lurie.
Council has some advice on this.
Ms. White.
Mr. Chair and Senator, it's true. It is the law on the books. However, after the hearing on the last 60-day residency requirement, I had some correspondence with Wisconsin and asked them, do you have the 60-day residency requirement still on the books? However, they sent me information that although it's still on the books, they no longer are required to meet the 60-day residency requirements in order to be eligible for the program. Why they haven't repealed this law, I have no idea. But I have an October memo from 1999 memo from Wisconsin indicating that although there still is a 60-day residency requirement, they're not implementing it, and so as a result, it hasn't been challenged under the new U.S. Supreme Court law.
And Ms. White, who are you in correspondence with in Wisconsin? Who reported that information to you?
This is a memo from the Department of Workforce Development. This memo conveys a policy change regarding W-2, which is Wisconsin's MFIP program, eligibility requirements related to durational residency. W-2 applicants are no longer required to meet a 60-day residency requirement to be eligible for W-2.
So is it the fact that they have a statute that requires something and their department is not acting under that statute? Is that the...
Mr. Chair, yes, I don't understand it. I mean, clearly if we're not, implementing a statute.
Is there a dispute in Wisconsin, to your knowledge, between the legislature and the department over this? Is that what's going on? I don't know. I'm just...
Basically, the 60-day residency requirement is on the books. You're absolutely right, Senator Gazelka. But in 1999, they decided that that was a policy that they weren't going to continue with, and so... They no longer impose the 60-day residency requirement.
Just to ask Senator, I'll get back to you. I want to get Senator Newman has been waiting, and did you have a...
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, Senator Lurie has brought up some pretty interesting questions, and, you know, I sit here as a legislator. I mean, my job is to legislate, as is yours, and I will rarely, if ever, vote in favor of or against a bill on the basis of what I fear a court or an appellate court will do or not do. I mean, they do their job, we do our job. And I will tell you that, you know, and I've said this before, over the years, I have disagreed with appellate courts in Minnesota and the U.S. Supreme Court over and over and over again. The only difference is their opinion counts and mine doesn't. But
well, sir, if no, in your, fact, your opinion counts here, I just want you to know that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But it, you know, if in fact, if I hear Senator Lurie correctly, there is in place a Supreme Court case that would render this legislation being proposed as unconstitutional. I would really like to see it. I would like to see a legal memo to that effect, maybe from Senate counsel. I acknowledge that Senator Lurie has read the case, but I don't know if I want to rely on his interpretation of it. The fact that Wisconsin has got it sounds like Wisconsin has got a statute in place for a 60-day residency requirement that maybe the counterpart to DHS in Minnesota isn't enforcing. I don't care. I don't care what DHS in Wisconsin is doing. So my input would be is I would like to run to ground this issue of whether or not Senate File 1835 is on all fours, on its face, unconstitutional under a case, a 1999 case from the U.S. Supreme Court. And if it's not unconstitutional on all fours, then it would be my inclination to simply go forward with the bill. If it is within the four corners of that 1999 case, if the Supreme Court and its current law that Senate file is 1835, then maybe we should back off. Or we'll have a conversation of whether or not we want to push back against the federal government.
Senator Lurie and then Senator Higgins.
You know, that's a fair point. I mean, I could see myself voting against certain bills that I believe in that don't meet with constitutional mandates and fighting on them. However, the statements were made on the record that it did and that this is why, and that's why it's important that we get on the record exactly what it is and the timelines and how they work. I guess I was mistaken about them repealing their law. I thought they had repealed their law. They just quit enforcing it, which makes it moot and unable to be sued upon. There's nobody harmed by it if they're not enforcing it, and they can't get into the courts to try to challenge the law today. And you don't have to rely on my read of the case. I did read you right from the Workforce Development Council that Wisconsin's own interpretation of the 1999 U.S. Supreme Court case of Sanchez said that their 60-day waiting requirement would not withstand the strict scrutiny that is the new federal mandate. So, you know, I mean, I'm not going to deny that you have the absolute right to vote for something that is unconstitutional, but you should take a look at it and that we need to challenge the statements made on the record when they're based on inaccuracies. And so that's the point of what I'm trying to make sure that we pursue fully and just understand. And then also, I mean, I'm going to have to say this is our second incredibly long hearing on something. That's where I start getting really troubled. There's really pressing needs of the people of Minnesota in our jurisdictional area. We've set what appears to be two full committee hearings. We're a month into session now. This is about all we're doing. And, you know, it's going to make very little difference to very few people. Those that it is going to make a difference to, it's going to make a really big difference to, and it's going to be incredibly harmful. And this is a lot of really valuable committee time that we're spending.
Senator Newman and we'll get to Senator Higgins.
Just a very brief response. It sounds as though from Senator Lori's comments that there's a group or somebody in Wisconsin who has interpreted the U.S. Supreme Court case. And I'm simply saying I don't want to rely on whatever group Senator Lori is referring to because I don't have the background. I don't even know if who he is relying on has the legal expertise to interpret the case.
All right. Fair enough. Senator Higgins.
This has been fascinating, Mr. Chair. And as Senator Newman said, he doesn't want to vote for things that are unconstitutional. He wants to have the knowledge going forward. But I see in this amendment on lines 24, 25, and 26 of the first page that we've got a little provision that every time I see it in a bill is a red flag to me that it's likely that there's something unconstitutional in this. This is that provision that says if any part of this is found unconstitutional, the rest of it will still stand. I see this only in legislation that is highly suspect constitutionally, and the history of the issue has shown that, you know, it gets struck down. So here we have it in here, which to me just says this is really problematic and it really shouldn't go forward. So I'm just adding that to the information that our attorneys here in this committee have given us. And I'm just thinking that Senator Gazelka is, you know, passionate about this issue, but I think it's not the time, it's not the place, it's not the group, and it's not the policy that we should be having. So, Mr. Chair, I'm going to move to lay this on the table.
Senator Higgins has moved to table Senate File 1835.
And a roll call, Mr. Chairman.
And a roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Benson.
No.
Fishbach.
No.
Hall.
No.
Hayden.
Yes.
Higgins.
Yes.
Hoffman.
No.
Lori.
Yes.
Marty.
Yes.
Newman.
No.
Nino.
No.
Rosen.
No.
Sharon.
Yes.
Han.
No.
Senator Han.
There being eight no's and five yeses, the bill is not tabled. And members, I would like to get to Senator Benson's bill. Senator Newman, did you have a comment you wanted to make?
Yeah, very briefly, Mr. Chairman.
And I have a question as well, Senator.
As to the severability clause issue, we do in fact often see that, and I think that this is in response, of course, to Senator Higgins' comments. I believe that the severability clause that we see in cases are there for two reasons. Number one, to reflect our legislative intent. And secondly, is just, frankly, fear of the least dangerous branch of government.
Thank you. And Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Han. I know this is going long, but I think this is really an important issue. I want to ask the question again, Senator, because I am still confused about what you've said. What I'm reading in the materials is data that you've put together with the assistance of our Senate counsel that shows the benefits to an adult and a child on various programs or monthly public assistance benefits for one adult and two children. And besides these constitutional issues, what we're talking about is also data that is questionable, but nevertheless that you're presenting, whether without getting into the accuracy of the data, it's data about the frequency with which people are moving into the state. You're focused on the numbers of people coming into the state and focused on the size of the benefit package to those people in comparison with other states.
So I'm trying to understand why you're presenting that information to us. What is that about? What are you trying to demonstrate to me with that information?
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted a broader, more data than less available to everyone here. I saw articles in the paper around a similar subject like this, only using one dollar source, not recognizing that there's quite a few dollar sources. But to focus on this particular bill, though, it's only focusing on one particular part, and that's the residency requirement. And I come back to, I think, as representatives for the state, we have an interest in people coming to Minnesota to work. So that's what this is focused on.
And just to follow up on that, if you don't mind, I find what you're saying completely disconnected to the arguments that you're presenting to the committee. The arguments and the issues that you're raising in your data are trying to raise concern that people are, our benefits are too generous and that the numbers are extraordinarily high for people coming into the state from other places. That data is talking about the problem that you're concerned about and that you're trying to deal with that problem by a residency requirement. And you can wrap it in other language, Senator, but it is clear from your last bill that that's what this is about, and it's clear because of the data that you're presenting to support this bill that that's what it's about. And it's not about encouraging people to work.
Senator Hayden and then Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Senator Gazelka, just in looking at the bill as I started to read it, I noticed that in Subdivision 2 exceptions, you've deleted where the county shall waive a 30-day residency requirement. So I infer that they wouldn't, that if they would, if you deleted where they would have a 30-day resident requirement for the purposes of living, coming to your county or coming to Minnesota without shelter, without food, and others, that is it your position, Senator Gazelka, that if someone showed up in your county and didn't have any place to live, any food for their children, that they still shouldn't get the benefits of MFIB or GA or our public assistance programs?
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hayden, we included the word may in those two parts to give the county some flexibility to make that decision, not required, but may be waived. If you're at 2.28, 2.29, I'm not sure if that's where you are at.
Yeah, or, I'm sorry, I didn't see.
There's two parts, places that we did that. That's not where you're at?
Not on what we
Well, I just don't see it. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Senator Gazelka, I just don't see where you put may. And if you,
I think, Senator Hayden, on 2.28 and 2.29, it says for purposes of eligibility for emergency assistance, which would cover, I presume, cases where someone showed up without anything, that the counties may waive that requirement. Is that your intention, Senator Gazelka?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, I think this is kind of deja vu all over again. It seems like we had this argument before where now we're saying that the county human service administrator, even if this bill goes into law, may, depending upon if they feel that the person or the family has a need, may just say, you know what, you don't have to be here for 60 days. We'll go ahead and give you the benefits now. Is that? I'm not being facetious. I really am trying to understand what the bill is trying to do if now we're giving the county administrators or the county human service administrators the ability to waive the bill, the law, in order to provide assistance for someone.
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, 1.22, it deals with emergency general assistance, and actually that was Senator Higgins' recommendation that in a prior bill that I thought made sense to be in this bill.
All right. Senator Lurie.
Yeah, Senator Gazelka, you said that really this was just about going from 30 to 60, and I had two other, you know, really significant changes to people struggling. Senator Hayden mentioned one of them, the getting rid of the hardship waiver that they shall, and I guess it is there as a may, I see, kind of. might be not as effective. But the other one is the way that you verify residents. Last time we had significant conversations about that, and it is significantly restricted from current law. And so it's not just 30 to 60. It's 30 to 60 with a significant restriction on the waiver requirement and a significant reining in of the manner in which you can validate residency. And let me just kind of highlight this. There used to be an ability, now under lines 112 to 115 on the A1 here, what's missing is the homeowner's vouching for somebody having lived with us. Let's just take, you know, an absolute disaster destroying a city in our country, you know, the Katrina disaster, with people, you know, left without any means anywhere of supporting themselves, and they go anywhere in the country they can find a place to be. And if they come to Minnesota, they got to wait 60 days. There's no hardship waiver. And if they find a homeowner that can, you know, see it in their heart to let them in, that homeowner can't even go under this change and say, yes, this individual has been living with me here in Minnesota and attempting to create residency in our fair state because they have no hope of returning to their home. And we're going to deny them for much longer than 60 days because they're not able to validate their residence under this change. So it's not just 30 to 60. It's 30 to 60 with an onerous additional restriction on the waiver and an incredibly onerous restriction added to the manner in which you verify your address that can harm people in really difficult ways. So it's not just 30 to 60.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if the bill had been moved, because it hasn't. If it has not, I would like to move the bill, because I do understand we have another bill up this afternoon or this morning, and we'd like to move it.
Members, we have had, I think, a very productive and useful discussion on this bill and a previous one that is similar, and Senator Fischbach moves that Senate File 1835 be...
I'd like to request a roll call.
Passed and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Mr. Chair.
And Senator Lurie requests a roll call to that motion. Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, we did have three people on the agenda, three citizens who came to speak on this. Are we going to deny them their opportunity?
I'm willing to hear some, since we have a motion in front of us, and we will take their testimony, and then we'll take the vote. So we'd like to hear. We have had testimony previously from Angel Buchner, I think, the previous bill, but she's on the list. And then Deb Housey and... And who is going to go first?
There's a little change up of people who are speaking. My name is Kim DeFranco. I'm speaking for...
I have Angel Buchner, Deb Housey, and Ebony Harris. Are those people here?
These two are here. Angel couldn't make it today. So I'm stepping in.
Okay. And your name again?
My name is Kim DeFranco. I'm a member of the Minnesota Coalition for a People's Bailout. We were here last week, so I'm going to add a little bit more to a testimony. Even though we're still in the middle of the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, you are opposed to cut critical social programs that families rely on to get them through this economic crisis. That it includes all the programs that you're all talking about. In reality, our families have been in economic crisis years before it hit the rest of the middle class. Now more and more of the middle class are either falling or just above the poverty line, which includes thousands of children. MFIP parents and other low-income workers are generally the last hired at a workplace, which means they're first fired, or we've been working temp jobs, and those jobs are generally not high-wage jobs. This means that the last hired, the first hired, so when they don't have a job, they don't have enough work quarters in a right time period to qualify for unemployment insurance. Welfare is the unemployment insurance for unemployment assistance for poor families and working families once their unemployment checks runs out. Everyone knows that unemployment is still massive. Tens of thousands of people, even with degrees and high skills, have difficulty finding jobs. And even Congress is debating whether or not to extend unemployment from period. So this is a telltale sign that this crisis is not over, and we don't have enough good-paying jobs to get ahead. So whatever the safety net we had from our families or our friends have been destroyed by this crisis. Our family and friends are unemployed. They're also homeless because of foreclosures, the foreclosure crisis. People and families have been struggling for a long time, and now in their time of need, you want them to cut them off with nowhere else to turn for a decent living. I see the language in the bill is to soften up some of the requirements of these residency requirements, but it still stinks. It's humiliating people that need help now. You should really stop tinkering with people's lives that need help. So how could you sit up here and make these laws that will devastate citizens of Minnesota? It is really unconscionable during this never-ending economic crisis. Instead of devastating families and the working people and the poor people of the state should be helping until the economy is back on track. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. DeFranco. Ms. Housie.
Well, I was here last week, and I just wanted to, I didn't know I was coming back again to testify against the same thing and just say a little more. You know, I'm one of the 99%, and you are included here, and we all use taxpayers' dollars. And I'm just not understanding what does it have to do with what's going on in Wisconsin about our state. You know, people come here from all over the world. They come from China, Hong Kong, Russia, Vietnam, you know, places here in the USA. And I don't think people are coming here to this state actually to feed and get money to live on. There's no way you can do that. The 1% is already moving out of the state because they don't want to pay the fair taxes, leaving us unemployed, not to have any jobs. And then when we spend all our money, our savings and stuff, we have no other choice but to seek out a program like the NFIP program to try to survive with our families and stuff. It's just ridiculous that I just can't understand about why people are so saying that people are coming here for welfare when they're not. If you get child care, you got to wait on a waiting list. If you get housing, you're waiting on a waiting list. If you need Section 8, it's a waiting list. It's a waiting list for everything that we do in our lives, you know? And I'm just thinking that people who voted you all in should be thinking and hoping that you are all paying attention to what is being said about the laws and what is going on in their lives, putting people, because we're looking up to you to making sure that you're making the right decisions about our livelihood, what's going on. I'm just having a personal thing. You know, I'm here just coming from not reading off anything, just thinking for me, being myself as a citizen here in Minneapolis, and hoping that if something was to happen to one of my children or living out of state, that they would be able to come here to get some kind of financial help, some kind of help to move forward to doing the things that they need to do. We all know that there is no jobs really out there for us to find. I can't even find a hamburger job, and I'm 54 years old, and I don't need a hamburger job. I would like to do what's in my profession. And I know people who have, I'm with a committee called Dress for Success, which gave me my outfit, you know, for interview, which they do all low-income people. And I have people that are there saying, and we go together, I have been looking for a job for 45 days. I have 45 applications in. Nobody has. I have looked for a job for 3 years. I still haven't had no job in my profession. People are seriously out there looking for jobs, professional jobs that can pay their housing, which we know is 200% in our income. It's just ridiculous. I know myself. I couldn't even live hardly, barely without help. If my family wasn't helping me right now today to survive. And I just hope that You are really, and people are paying attention to what is being said about the NFIP grant, about the grant that hasn't been raised in 26 years for people to help with their income and their families and their bills and to survive and not to be in a crisis, because we are all in a crisis. I'm in a crisis myself. People are in a crisis emotionally, physically, mentally. I'm in a, you know, when things happen to them in their lives, things just happen, and people don't look for things to happen. People can, want, and want to do. I'm a witness to that. I'm around people like that, you know, and I, from all walks of life, you got to, you, no one wants to go to the food shelf, but they have to sometimes because I ran out of food. Things happen. I got sick. I needed some, I have to go someplace to help some meat to pay for my medical. I don't have medical. I can't go to the doctor. I have diabetes. You know, I'm being turned away left and right. It's not fair. There's a lot of things that you don't understand that is going on in your communities with the people that put you in there. You need to go out and look and see what is going on. It is a devastation out there. It truly, truly is. I see and I live it all my... I feel sorry. I feel sorry for myself. I feel hopelessness for myself, but I still know that I have to breathe through it and come through it, because there's things out there that you don't understand why people do the things that they do. And it's called survival. You're going to make sure that your child gets something to eat. You're going to make sure that yourself, your family, your friends, whatever the cost is. And the cost is, I'm seeing what's going on. I'm not a big person to come to. I don't want to keep on coming on along and along. But I just want people to have a gut and a conscience that you have people that are, everybody knows somebody who on EBT, on NFIP, low incomes, SSI, Social Security, the whole nine yards, and who is downtrodden. So I just want to speak for myself and everybody else that I could, 99%, we know who the 1% is, that things have got to change. It's got to change, and people got to have compassion for other people and what passing these laws.
Thank you, Ms. Housey. Ebony Harris.
Hi.
And I please testify to the bill.
Okay. Okay, well, my name is Ebony Harris, and I'm a life, just for the record, I'm a lifelong resident, Minnesota resident. I have four children. I am a domestic abuse survivor. This bill here is very, very mean-spirited and humiliating to people that are like me. I'm here representing people that cannot even be here to speak for themselves or are very intimidated in talking with politicians, because I hear it a lot. I'm one of the many people that's been laid. I've been laid off for the third time. I'm surviving on $77 a week, and that runs out in unemployment. That runs out in 2 weeks. I can't go back to MFIP because I tried. I have tried dearly to get back on, back off, and the policies that you guys come up with to cut down on programs to lift people out of poverty, that's what throws them off. This bill here will throw people, it will devastate families. You will definitely hear about a lot of chaos if this bill is passed, meaning we will all, as citizens of Minnesota, we will have to pay for that, regardless whether people like it or not. It's classism, because there is a class war going on. Whether you guys like it or not, this is war on poor people, and it's immoral. I was raised in the church by my mother that taught me to care for your fellow man. One thing about Minnesota, me growing up here, we always were prided in that, not by payments or generous payments, because I don't know where that's coming from, because generous payments, they are not. With rent being over $1,000, because not everybody can get Section 8, people are doubling up, people are in the streets, shelters are full. It's just every day I go online or I watch TV, and I'm hearing about people the same way, and I'm just appalled that Minnesota is even going here with this residency. And to me, that personally, that's attacking a certain segment of our population. With our unemployment rate among African Americans, is like, last I heard, was like 16%. They won't hire us. So how are we supposed to go, and I'm not going to say we, how are, especially women with children, how are they supposed to go look for a job in a 36-month period when half of the people that are that people of color that have women, excuse me, that have children, how are they supposed to go out and get jobs when the private sector refuses to hire us in the first place? This is very mean-spirited, and I hope you guys find some conscience somewhere, because that's why we put you here. And it seems like the political climate, what's going on, we have forgotten we the people. Now, that's what I learned in school. I'm just shocked that this is my home state, that we're becoming just tyrants and picking on poor people. Just coming here, I saw six people, half of them women, with signs begging for change. Just whatever stereotypes, whatever you guys have heard about people, they're moving here. I don't see anybody moving here. I met women in shelters that were getting away from abusive situations. That's why they had to come here. But by them making them wait 30 to 60 days, that could be somebody's life, in which it is. This is it. Like I said, I'm going to say it again. These are not generous benefits. I don't know. I want that for the record, and I want everybody in this room to understand me. These are not generous benefits. This bill seems rushed and desperate to get poor people, to keep poor people and working class people from coming here. That's me. And I feel that this is very personal. I'm sorry to get loud, but this is ridiculous how we're treating people and how people can sit here. Because at the end of the night, y'all gonna go home to comfortable places. There's millions of women and children that are in shelters that are probably full. I even met somebody that was sleeping in their van. What kind of state are we becoming? I prided myself from being from Minnesota. You know, and this bill, not everybody from Chicago is coming up here to sit on welfare. Sometimes most people that I know that are on welfare are working. But guess what? The jobs that are out here, they're only paying $6, $7 an hour. Eight is the highest I've seen. How do I know? Because I've been looking for a job, and March 31st will be a year that I have been unemployed. And they don't even want to hire you if you are unemployed. So that's another bias. This is too much bias. This Minnesota Nice, that Minnesota Nice is a myth. This bill here, I'm sorry, people, I want you all to know, this is not Minnesota Nice. I hear statistics. I've just been hearing about Wisconsin. I don't care about Wisconsin right now. I care about my home state. And I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I'm appalled that politicians here as well as in D.C. are playing with people's lives. You guys got a home to go to. You guys got food to get to. You got a job. I want a job. I want to work. And there's thousands of women here in this state that want to work. But they can't with bills like this that keep, and when you cut programs, like I'm surprised Dress for Success is still around. Stuff like that is very serious to us. This is a matter of life and death, people. It's a class war, and it has to stop. Do not pass this bill. Because if you guys pass this bill, honey, you're going to see devastation like you couldn't believe. It's going to look like a third world country if it's not looking like that already.
Thank you. We have a motion on the table before us and a roll call has been requested. And the motion, Senator Fischbach has moved that Senate File 1835 as amended be passed and referred to the Finance Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Benson.
Yes.
Fischbach.
Yes.
Hall. Hayden.
No.
Higgins.
No.
Hoffman.
Yes.
Lori.
No.
Marty.
No.
Newman.
Yes.
Nino.
Yes.
Rosen.
Yes.
Sharon. Han.
Yes.
Hall.
Yes.
Sharon.
She's on her way.
Sharon.
No.
There being 8 ayes and 5 nays, the bill passes and referred to finance. Thank you, Senator Gazelka. And Senator Benson, are you wanting to take up the bill?
Mr. Chair, I'm ready. We can begin, and
in a
timely manner, we'll...
Why don't we do that? Senator Benson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I move Senate File 1834. This is, and I have an author's amendment. I will take that privilege as long as it's my
sure.
first time for the bill.
All right, and members, I think the A2 amendment is being distributed, so Senator Benson moves as an author's amendment, the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Senator Benson, the bill is now amended to your wishes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The purpose of this bill is to clean up our EBT program. It's not to restrict or reduce benefits. Right now, the cash portion of the EBT card is a $21 million a month state appropriation if you include MFIP, GA, and MSA. And what we want to focus on is that we're using Minnesota tax dollars to take care of Minnesota's poor and to spend those dollars in Minnesota so those economic benefits accrue back to the taxpayers who are paying into these funds. In the amendment, we did expand it to neighboring states so as to remove any undue burden and also to be good neighbors. Additionally, the amendment designated that not just debit transactions, but also ATM transactions would be forbidden outside the state. There is a fiscal note associated with this. And initially, there is some cost because we have to change the communication system that our EBT transactions move through. When you swipe an EBT card, just like when you swipe a debit card, it moves through a national clearinghouse. The banks have all agreed on a protocol. It runs through processing centers in Dallas or Milwaukee, and then it bounces back from your bank and says, yes, there's funds, or it bounces back from the EBT account and says, yes, there are funds available, executes the transaction. So the fiscal note is related to us separating from that national contract, renegotiating with a local contract. So that's the initial cost. We see in later years there is some savings because there is material usage of these benefits outside of the state of Minnesota. This is not to punish people, but it's to discourage mailing the cards to people who are not intended to use it. It's to set a standard that says you live here and we're going to take care of you and we expect you to spend the money here. And so it is in that spirit that this bill is offered. I'm open for questions in the time that we have remaining.
And, Senator Benson, the amendment adds to, in addition to vendors, ATMs, and also your original language says outside of Minnesota, but makes an exception for contiguous states so that the cards would still be able to be used in North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin.
That's
is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Senator Lurie.
The fiscal note... what is the effect on the – is the fiscal note drafted to the A1 or is it drafted to the original bill?
Can you help me, Mr. Albrecht?
Senator Benson or Mr. Albrecht.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson and Senator Lurie, this fiscal note is not drafted to the amendment. I'm not sure, given the way the fiscal note was put together, how substantially the projected savings would change, but – this bill, if it goes on to finance, we would get a revised fiscal note for it.
Senator
the costs, I think, in fiscal year 2013 wouldn't change.
Senator right. Lurie.
I mean, that would be, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that would be the case, that the costs of initially implementing it would remain the same, and the benefits in the out years. I mean, I think most of the expenditures are in neighboring states. So, I mean, it would, you know, you'd still have this cost, which is, you know, something to look at, and it would eliminate, my understanding is, not having dug into it any deeper, it would eliminate the lion's share of the savings that you're experiencing here on this fiscal note with this amendment. So you might want to think, if this really is wise, it might take many years to get the return on investment.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Benson, if I read your amendment correctly, it will allow holders of the card to obtain cash in neighboring states. Could you tell me what the reasoning is in allowing cardholders to obtain cards outside of the state of Minnesota if it is for neighboring or contiguous states?
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, as Senator Hoffman can attest to, there's a lot of travel back and forth in proximate communities in North Dakota, and, for example, our Hudson neighbors. People might be traveling to a job there, or maybe they have a relative who does their child care there and helps them in that way. And so to be good neighbors, their food stamp benefits will be eligible in states across the nation. But if they're stopping at the grocery store and they need cash to pay their babysitter, we allow that. We really want to discourage. You probably have seen the map, and I apologize for not bringing it today, transactions in Alaska and Hawaii and Florida that do not seem to fit the intent of Minnesota providing this program to people.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the fiscal note where it talks about our state following Quest operating rules, which it looks like they were developed as a partnership with government and financial institutions related to portability and interoperability of the government benefits across state lines and whatever all. And this would put us outside that framework. So I guess my question, Senator Benson, is do you know, do all states work under these Quest operating rules, dealing with the portability? We're going to be an outlier, and there would be cost re-regulation, renegotiating of separate agreements with every card processing entity. What do you know about that? Yes, I'll just try.
Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I recall from when I started this work last year, and I did not verify, either 48 or 45 states comply with Quest processing. And yes, I acknowledge the upfront cost. But the hope of this bill, the purpose of this bill, is to reduce that outside the state cash spending and to keep it in Minnesota where we believe it belongs. And so, yes, there is upfront cost, but I believe in the long run it makes program better.
Mr. Chair, my other question is, do you know what other states do? Do other states also restrict this benefit to in-state only?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I did not look into other states specifically. I know there have been bills moved in other states with this same direction, but I have not checked if there are any currently functioning in statute. I apologize.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Benson, I'd like to applaud you for your willingness to work on this and to bring this A2 amendment forward. I think you've been very accommodating in this issue. I believe that everybody around this table knows that this system needed some reform, and you did that, but you also listened to the needs of people that are using these EBT cards. And so I think it's very accommodating. I think actually the system's going to run a lot more smoothly and more efficiently with this these changes and this direction. Yeah, there might be a cost. We all know about these fiscal notes. But in the long run, the program is going to be better serving the people that are using these cards. And I know you can move the bill. But Mr. Chair, I'd like to move this bill.
All right. So Rosen moves that the Senate File 1834 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance. Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, on that motion, I mean, I guess I asked this the other day. What are we going to do here in committee in terms of bills with costs? Are you planning on pulling them together just procedurally into an omnibus bill, or are these things going to be hitting the floor one at a time with costs? And, you know, how are members going to be treated when they bring bills with costs to the table? I know we just let Senator Gazelka's bill go, and you sent it to the Finance Committee. I didn't see a fiscal note on it today, I didn't think.
You're correct, Senator Lurie. That was a bill that did not have a fiscal note, but they anticipated providing one that presumably would show some savings, but they wanted to bring that to have a chance to put that note together, bring that to Finance. So we will see a note on that.
Will we in our committee see the fiscal note on that bill? I mean, it is, we are a Finance Committee and here as well, and we should have valid fiscal notes before us in this committee. If, you know, I'd like to see them brought back here and have an omnibus bill put together. I think it's a disaster procedurally to send willy-nilly, you know, bills with financial implications to the Senate floor. I mean, it's a dangerous precedent.
Senator, I've been in conversations with the House about the topic of an omnibus bill or not, and frankly, we have not reached agreement on that, and we need to see what the February forecast provides in terms of whatever finance flexibility we may have. There have been a number of requests. There are other bills that we will see that may have some financial implication, and what I've told people is that we will hear bills, and to the extent that we have flexibility to deal with the financial aspect of them, then we will, but we need to see what the February forecast will bring. So I think this is acceptable to move it to Finance, and if we need to bring it back and include it into an omnibus bill, we can do that.
Senator Jan?
Senator Rosen?
I've sat on this committee for many years, 8-9 years, and I can remember many times when we've moved a bill through this committee without a fiscal note, a proper fiscal note. So I know this that it would be coming back. We will have a fiscal note on Senator Gazelka's, but that is not unprecedented, Senator Lurie. And everybody knows that reform does cost money, and I think this is actually well worth the dollars to make sure that we get this right and move forward with this kind of reform.
Mr. Chair, in response to that, on that same issue, I agree. I mean, we have moved, and I've sat on this committee too, and I've also raised these concerns, you know, in the previous construction of the legislature as well. We have not let them go to the floor, and I haven't gotten an answer as to what it means in today's configuration, procedurally, when we send a bill to the Finance Committee. I don't know if we're going to see it again. I don't know if we're going to be able to do our obligation to oversee the fiscal expenditures within the health and human service world if we let bills go that don't even have a fiscal note yet, like Senator Gazelka's, and if we let this one go when we've acknowledged that the fiscal implications are going to be different. And so I'm just trying to understand the process and figure out if these are going to be hitting the floor or if we're going to be putting together a bill. I mean, these are valid questions, and I'm not crying foul just yet, but this makes me nervous not having any clarity as to what it is we're going to be doing.
I appreciate your comment. And Senator Higgins, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I was just thinking that in the previous iterations of committees, we had a policy committee and we had a finance committee where we would put the policy part together and then we'd go get a fiscal note and then, you know, deal with it there. And one of the difficulties of having a combined committee is we don't have that second step where you know, once we figured out what the policy should be, then we go figure out what the cost is and how to pay for it. And that's what's missing, or one of the things that's missing in you know, the joint committees that we're doing this year.
Senator Hayden.
Senator Hayden, did you?
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, I was just trying to follow Senator Higgins' kind of path. So, and to think about what Senator Lurie said, Senator Benson talked about the upfront cost to change the configuration, and then Senator Rosa talked about, you know, this is a good reform. But the problem is that with Senator Benson's amendment, to Senator Lori's point, we don't know if the fiscal note is accurate, because there is some sense that most of the transactions out of state, or I shouldn't say most, but a number of transactions out of state are happening in the contiguous states. So we really don't know. So even from a good government reform perspective, we really don't know how much we actually save and figure out how long it will take for that return on the investment that we made. So the problem that I'm having is, I mean, I got some other problems with the bill, but I won't go into that. But the problem, just in terms of trying to figure out if this is actually good reform, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, is we don't know, because the fiscal note doesn't reflect the amendment.
Appreciate the comments, Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I'm talking about the fiscal note as well, and I would ask Council to consider this when this is being rewritten. The assumptions are that the recipient would not be able to use their cash portion outside of a 5-state geographic area. And because they can't, there will be cost savings. But there's nothing in the bill, and it's not your intent to take away eligible cash or other benefits from the person. The benefits will remain the same if they're eligible for them and be on that card. So I think there is a real flaw in assuming that because you change the geography, while they still retain the same cash benefit level, that they won't spend their cash benefits. I think that the person has the benefits and they need them and they're restricted from certain things. They will honor the restrictions, but they won't change having access to the benefits that they need for their families. So the assumption that there'll be savings from this, I think, is really challengeable.
Right. Senator Rosen renews her motion for Senate File 1834 be recommended to pass, referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Mr. Chair?
Aye.
Aye. I'm sorry, I was going to request a roll call. I wasn't quick on the trigger.
Those opposed?
No.
No.
Bill passes. And members, appreciate your attention today, and apologize for running over a few minutes, but we'll try to be more on time. Thank you. We are adjourned.